From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hi, welcome back to the New Model Advisor Show. I'm Julian Bovell, and today we're joined by John Greer, Head of Retirement Policy at Quilter. John, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, welcome. So 2 weeks to the day, or effectively to the day since the budget. What little bit of distance, what's your assessment of the landscape and what Rachel Reeves delivered?
So I think we're all pretty relieved on some of the speculation which didn't actually occur. So tax-free cash reductions, reduction in tax relief, those sorts of things didn't come through. So I looked at this, and I was thinking about this last night because I knew you were going to ask me a question about this. So I was reflecting on really what's happening, what's going forward. So this feels like a budget for the longer term investment and growth, a little bit less sort of short termism really than what we've seen in historic sort of fiscal events. And then, you look at Rachel Reeves, and she is an economist. She has an economist background. And I thought, let's look at this. She's very much sort of always said she likes sort of Keynesian economics, so very much interested in how she can drive growth through increased government spending, especially in times of uncertainty, arguably what we've got now. I think she says that the economy should basically benefit those who contribute to growth through innovation and investment in productive activities, rather than those people who take or extract value from assets.
Yeah.
So that's quite a key theme for me here. Then you look at some of the tax changes that we've seen, and hey presto, that is exactly what we're looking at a bit further on. Pension review that we've got going on at the moment, trying to get more money into productive assets, that's going to be a theme going through this entire parliament, I think.
Yeah.
So that's my kind of assessment, and clearly we've got some big change on pensions in terms of IHT as well, but more indirect changes on pensions too, which initially don't look fantastic,
no,
to be honest.
I think we'll come on to those, but just on the budget itself, and I suppose this government's view of how to drive growth and investment in the UK, is Rachel Reeves staking her entire career on what was quite a controversial and quite a big budget, $40 billion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we can all kind of
we
can debate around whether or not they knew how much they had to raise in terms of ongoing tax, and whether or not that was always their plan. But we do have a distinctly different kind of outlook in terms of how much spending there is. This is why I say this is a very much an economist's outlook here. Clearly she needs to raise more money. My sort of view on it, I think, is that she didn't expect probably the backlash that we've seen, especially on the employer NI increases. And to put that into perspective, when you look at pensions, so the average earnings in the UK are about 36,000, roughly. When you have a reduction in the secondary threshold from 9,100 to 5,000, and an increase in your NI to 15%, that's about £970 extra employer NI that employer's got to find. Compare that to their minimum auto enrollment contributions of 3%. I mean, that would roughly work out a shade under £900 a year. So employers had a long phase in time for those extra costs. Employers now have between 2 weeks ago and April to start thinking about this. So it's a big increase in expenses there. So I think it has staked reputation on this. I think it's an all-in bet on getting the economy growing.
Yeah, and before this, we were sort of speaking about our own sort of experiences speaking to employers in the run-up to this. What's the sort of reaction that you yourself have heard just sort of out and about from employers? They're quite angry about this, I think.
I think so, yes. So I think the impact will really depend on the makeup of employees there. How many people they've got who maybe are at the lower end. You've got changes in national living wage as well, which they've got to deal with. So it's a double whammy for a lot of these employers. I think there has been, from our perspective, we've seen a significant amount of interest in salary sacrifice, because clearly it's a valuable employee benefit, plus also helps the employer manage some of the increase in NI too. And for what we've been hearing is a lot of employers who have been sharing their entire NI saving with employees through sacrifice contributions, etc., are now considering whether they pare back some of that saving rather than giving all of it over to the employees, whether they pare it back some margin there. And then employers who don't offer salary sacrifice are probably looking at it for the first time. Those that don't offer it and aren't intending to offer it, you know, clearly they're talking about, you know, salary rises might not be where they thought they might be, or indeed they might not be taking on staff which they thought they would do. So I think the position of employers will really depend on their own personal drivers and their makeup of their workforce and the structure of their benefits which they're giving. But let's be clear, you know, this is not great news for them, and they are going to struggle with this, and it is going to have an implication. It isn't something which is just going to be absorbed, and you're not going to see some form of cost increase maybe to customers.
The working people argument isn't going to hold, is it? It's going to be reflected back on paychecks from April.
Yeah, I always found that sort of working person argument is kind of, yeah, it's entirely politics, isn't it? You know, but the reality is very different on the ground, because ultimately people pay for these things, you know, and you know, the politics around it is just optical.
Yeah. Later this week, Rachel Reeves will deliver her Mansion House speech. Prior to the budget, we had the pensions review, the first stage, which closed, which was on investment. What are you expecting on Thursday, and what are we expecting from the pension review second stage as well?
So really interesting to see how much of an interim update we get in the Mansion House speech. So we expected the interim report to be between now and the end of the year. So whether or not we'll see that from Rachel Reeves and how much detail we'll see on Thursday is sort of open to sort of speculation, I suppose, at this moment in time. But broadly speaking, for those not too close to that sort of first part of the pension review, there was a couple of core aims in it, and clearly the first one is to try and get DC schemes and the local government pension scheme as well to invest in more UK productive assets, that sort of stuff. And the way they're thinking of doing that is, one, through consolidation of the pensions market, because compared to, say, international counterparts, so they've been looking at Canada, they've been looking at Australia as well, those pension market is significantly more concentrated, whereas we have, relatively speaking, quite a diverse, especially on the trust side, thousands of schemes. Although you could argue that actually consolidation has significantly happened in the UK already through existing system measures. So clearly want to accelerate that going forward. What does that look like for the workplace pensions market? Well, you've probably got, 20 master trusts in the market currently, and maybe they want to go to, you know, 12-ish, or maybe a few less than that. But, you know, the majority of stuff is going into a sort of master trust already. The size of the prize, when you look at it, is significant. You know, local government pension scheme has nearly 400 billion worth of assets in there. Well, last time we looked, you know, you had sort of proportion of UK assets and sort of infrastructure, that sort of stuff, nearing around sort of 17%. That's a lot lower than, say, Australia. Their sort of domestic market investment is more like 25% and above. And I think that's the sort of thing that Rachel Reeves is looking to try to achieve. You look at the DC sector at the moment is, what, 650 billion. Contract-based GPPs are probably just more than half of that currently, but, you know, whether that changes slightly going the makeup going forward, I think it probably will do. And they're, you know, forecasting in sort of 10-year sort of mark on this is that there's going to be a sort of £1 trillion in workplace. So not surprising that they want some of this to go into UK assets. And so I think that's, you know, this is not just a new thing. I mean, we had local government pension schemes who've been running as funds of 86 different funds. We've already had asset pooling into sort of 8 broad sort of pooled funds. And I think the first element of that consultation was about, you know, do you think that's really benefiting? Do you reckon that's what we should be pushing forward? So I'm hoping for a decent update. The themes from that will probably be, is the government going to mandate trustees and schemes to invest in UK assets?
Will they?
Or are they going to incentivise? So I think a bit like the budget on this one, you're not quite sure really what this government are going to do, because the cards are really close to their chest. But I know that the pensions minister is quite keen on this one. Yeah. I think more probably keener on the mandation part. So we shall see. Yeah. But you have got that sort of problem, haven't you, that trustees are there saying, well, it kind of tramples all over our fiduciary duty if you're going to mandate this certain amount of goes in here.
Of why that money is in those trusts.
And I can understand as well, when you're looking at wider regulatory changes, especially around, you know, we've had the value for money frameworks being worked on for some significant amount of time, there is concern there, isn't there, that if you were going to require greater investment into a market which, to be honest, hasn't been, you know, knocking the lights out or whatever for a while, that if it impacts your investment performance and you're an outlier because you've taken that position, based on some of the consultation we've seen, there is a risk to a workplace pension scheme from doing that, and that shouldn't really be underestimated. So it's just making sure that the broader regulatory change environment takes into account also what the government's trying to do, so it also fits together, and I'm really looking interested to see where this falls. So yes, this is incredibly important on Thursday. It's going to ripple through the entire pension sector.
I think so. And so back to the budget then. How do you view the budget in a pension sense? Was it good or bad for them?
So I'm going to say broadly, I think it's not great.
Okay.
But why have I said that? Yeah. The employer NI increase, as I've mentioned, is put so much extra cost onto employers that they're going to be looking at this and going, well, this increase on its own, as I said, is more than their minimum auto enrollment contributions for an average earner in the UK. So that's not particularly great. We had automatic enrollment reform, which was penciled in for this decade, where they're trying to increase your adequacy, etc., in retirement. So trying to increase those minimum contributions up to a level, you know, and people have been calling for 12% of earnings, etc. Does that feel likely now, given the backlash we've already had from employers, that we're going to ask them again to make significantly more contributions? So it feels like to me that this one's kicked into the very long grass, and I'd probably be surprised if we see a reduction in the early stage where people are auto-enrolled, or, you know, a reduction in the lower earnings threshold for purpose of minimum contributions, where they take it right down to the first pound of earnings.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's coming soon.
The previous government had extended the automatic enrolment age reduction until 2026, I think, but it doesn't seem likely that that's going to be implemented then, does it?
Can you imagine?
Employers would be quite cross.
So this is the second part of the pension review, isn't it? So we hope to hear something on Thursday about the second element of the pension review, which is around retirement outcomes and adequacy, because currently we don't really have that detail at the moment in terms of, other than a very high headline, what that'll include. So maybe we'll see a further long-term plan for how you increase adequacy by increased contributions, taking into account maybe the economic backdrop, financial burden on employers currently.
Yeah.
And so that'd be interesting to see, you know, whether there's always been this plan, and actually what we're just seeing is it folding out in front of us, and a very different view on the priority for this government in terms of pensions. The priority feels existing money to help the economy grow will then enable them to increase adequacy in the future, but we've already seen the OBR think that this is going to take some years to come forward, and this is why I'm saying this is a long-term view. There's no short-termism in this budget and from this Chancellor.
stuff. There was quite a lot of things that were speculated prior to the budget. Pension tax-free lump sum, pension yes. tax relief. Why do you think they ultimately left those policy areas alone?
For tax-free cash, is one of those things which would probably have got quite a bit of backlash and ultimately impacts public sector workers. And yes, they could have carved public sector workers out from any changes, but that's not a great way to design a tax system if you have distrust in public institutions, because if the private sector thinks, well, they get a great deal and we pay all the costs for it, yeah. that kind of unravels, and that's not really...
They're not also getting that with the NI.
Well, yeah, I guess, though, that they'd argue that it's just money slushing around. Yeah. That, you know, they give it back to the Treasury will give it back to them in higher budgets. So, you know, ultimately, it's neither here nor there, I suppose, they would say on that, on the employer NI increase. Yeah. Except I'd say, well, it depends if it impacts your pay reviews going forward.
Yeah.
It depends if it impacts anything in terms of a review of remuneration in the public sector, because I think we have had some calls from various different people saying that the problem with public sector pensions is the relative generosity, and that actually what they should be looking at is the overall remuneration package, and maybe slightly moving away from the generosity of the pension provision and more to increasing pay. And that might kind of reduce some of the problems which they keep hitting every time they look at pensions tax relief. They've got to have one eye on the impact on the public sector. And if we think about some of the changes that we've had on the higher end around tapering, all that sort of stuff, it hasn't been for high earners outside of the public sector that have driven it. It's been high earners in the public sector which have driven or forced the government to change their policy on pensions taxation. That's not going to change going forward. They've got to address this at some point.
Yeah, got to fix the issues. On that, I suppose we can come on to inheritance tax on pensions, perhaps the government's landmark pensions policy in the budget.
Yes.
Quite a technical document they released on the day. We spoke three or four times throughout the course of the day, you helping me understand it. What is your sort of understanding, and what are your thoughts on it two weeks out from it being released?
So for those who haven't, who aren't too sure what is being consulted on, this was a document which came out fairly much immediately.
Yeah.
It isn't a consultation on whether or not unused pension funds are going to be subject to IHT. That's a policy that's been made. It is around the process and the calculation of IHT. Mm. And by that, what they're proposing is that pension schemes become jointly liable for any inheritance tax due on unused pension assets, which is, you know, a dramatic change from where we are today, because today IHT doesn't really figure in pensions unless you've got a few sort of specific circumstances where there is no discretion on the payment of death benefits. And actually, you know, the NHS pension scheme, for example, death in service lump sum, if it's not paid to a spouse, paid to a child, somebody else, you know, that falls in the estate. So that's just an example of today where it already hits. The other circumstance where IHT might hit today is where you transfer and you're in ill health and you don't survive for 2 years, and then you're sort of brought into an estate and there's a calculation there to put a value on that sort of lost estate. So where we are going forward, though, is income tax, you know, treatment isn't changing. So your pre and post age 75 income tax treatment is there. But now that pensions are brought into this situation, I think the revenue are consulting because they are saying, well, that's quite a significant asset to be bringing in. The personal representatives probably aren't going to be able to have the money to pay an increased IHT bill. Therefore, in order to help with this, we are going to put some of the liability to pay for that IHT onto scheme administrators. What that then involves is a rather complex process, which they have set out. Now, I think they've looked at it and gone, my goodness, that feels like a complex process.
Hence leaving so much time between announcing policy and entry.
Exactly. So they've kind of put out a consulting on this process. And the way they see this working is personal representative lets all the schemes know the members died. the scheme will then have to provide the personal representatives with specific information. So these are the death benefits, these are the beneficiaries. Any type of death benefit which is exempt from IHT, so your spouse exemptions, all that stuff, will continue to apply. Personal representatives get all this information in. HMRC said that they will design a calculator that will be able to tap all this information in. It'll spurt out a figure. Mm. It'll say, right, this is the amount of the nil rate band which you have to proportion or is proportioned between these pension schemes. That information is sent to the pension scheme. They will then calculate any IHT due on the best benefits, pay that off to the revenue, to the quarterly accounting for tax, let the revenue know. At that point, they can then say to the beneficiaries, now we can pay out death benefits. All of that process has got to be done within 6 months. Otherwise, your standard interest charges will apply because the scheme administrator is jointly liable for IHT. The scheme administrator is thinking, crumbs, I'm going to be on the hook for some interest here on what could be sizable amounts of money. Yeah. You know, this feels like a painful process. Running discretionary death benefit processes currently sometimes last months anyway without
beyond,
any of this.
Beyond 6 months.
Can do, especially if you have very complex family structures. Yes, it can. It can take longer than that. So what do I think? I think this process will probably change.
Yeah.
Will that lead to maybe a change in the effective tax rate? Maybe. Maybe the fact that, you know, we've got a reasonable period of time until this is implemented is actually the government's thinking, well, look, we had a big change in pensions taxation recently with the abolition of the lifetime allowance. That wasn't a great example of considered tax policy, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think the opinion of a lot of others as well.
Yeah.
And it was chaotic.
Mm.
And I'm not criticising HMRC, who are given a very difficult thing to do in a very short period of time. But effectively, we designed a new tax system for pensions extremely fast, which is still being fixed today with draft regulations.
As we saw with the tax-free pension loophole abroad getting closed.
All these sorts of things. There's other elements to this new system which will only come out as we really delve into it. It took a few years for the original pension simplification to bed in. There are still elements of this, even with these new regulations come through, which don't really fit together fantastically.
Yeah.
So my kind of view is that, you know, we've seen some examples in the press recently of some extremely high marginal rates of tax by bringing pensions in, especially where somebody has some reasonable value of free estate assets and you have the reduction in your residence nil rate band.
Do you think that's something they'll have to change? Because, I mean, there's been talk of people being subject to a 90% tax if their estate is worth over 2 million and they have over 350,000 in their pension pot.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So you can get absolutely crazy rates, theoretically, anything up to sort of 90-odd% if you're going to take out the entire pension fund at the very high rates of income tax. So I look at this and I think, you know, that is a hard one to justify. Surely this is too hard. The IFS 2 years ago said, you know, IHT on pensions looks extremely generous when you compare it to other assets.
Yeah.
They did not say, yes, you just apply IHT on it and income tax.
Just as a flat.
They did not say that. That was not, they said that would lead to very high rates of tax.
Mm.
They proposed that a portion of any unused pension funds would be subject to IHT. They also looked at the ordering of how that was deducted. And I didn't think they said IHT first and then income tax. In fact, from memory, they went income tax first, possibly assume a basic rate, and then IHT afterwards there.
Yeah.
They also talked about a transitional regime because they said it would feel like retrospective taxation if this was brought in relatively swiftly.
Mm.
The government might say, well, we're given 2 years. It's a bit difficult, though, because in 2015, you effectively put out a regime. Now, I know some will say it looked really good, too good to be true. The fact is the rules were the rules what they were, and people planned for that. Now they're in a really difficult position. If they're over the age of 75 and have reasonable unused funds, maybe they've already started drawing them down. This is going to create a rather large tax charge, and in some circumstances, really high So I think these things,
generation, is it?
Yeah, I think these things are clearly coming to the Treasury's attention, and we might see some movement. I'm not saying we definitely will, but be under no illusion, these are the conversations which providers, advisors, etc., you know, will be having with whether it's HMRC, but Treasury certainly, because, you know, even at estimates previously from the IFS, we're talking about, you know, maybe up to 2 billion could be generated from this. And that was on a lot more watered down proposal. Mm. If you just look at the own government's assessment of the costings on this, they said, you know, 230-ish thousand estates will leave some form of DC, DB, etc., unused savings, which could be caught by IHT. 10,500 will be brought into the IHT net where they wouldn't have done historically. Another 38,500 will see their IHT bill increase from where it was. So those would have already been subject to some form of IHT, and their bill would be 34,000 in addition. Basic maths on, you know, 34,000 times by 38,500, you know, that's nearly 1.5 billion on its own for a relatively small number of people. Now, I think this is underestimating the true impact. I think they're going to raise significant billions from this. Mm. And some of the marginal, some of the effective rates we're talking about are so significant, it could dwarf that figure. So, yeah. So it's really down to whether or not, you know, when they look at, sit, stand back from this, they say, actually, we think we can water this down and still achieve our objective of raising. Yeah, exactly. So my kind of view on it is there's a long way to go till 2027.
And perhaps a silly question to follow up that with, but I mean, what kind of impacts might this have on the pensions landscape? You've said to me before that you think that this will have a marked impact on how people view their pensions and what they do with it during their lives.
Yes. So the incentive to use pensions as a wealth transfer is gone.
Yeah.
And that's gone now.
What do you say to the people that perhaps even the director of the IFS who would say that ultimately that's fair enough? They're not there to be used as inheritance tax vehicles. They're there to be, it's your money that you've earned. Yeah. You should use it in your own life.
So clearly pensions are to provide pensions. They were never intended as a wealth transfer. Mm. That has been exacerbated by government policy in 2015, and to a lesser extent some of the LTA abolition stuff has also exacerbated that to some degree. So I personally agree that wealth transfer isn't the role of pensions. It's, you know, it wasn't the main aim for them. The impact this will have, though, is that some people, based on the rules, will have had accrued significant value which now they need to do something with. It's those people who are already over the age of 75 now are going to have to start thinking about what they're going to do, not waiting till 2027, but now.
Yeah.
They'll be on the phone to their advisor going, what are we going to do now?
Yeah.
Because you can't wait 2 years. In 2 years, you can do a lot of things. You can start taking a bit more income. If you're really still interested in, you know, sharing some of this pension fund which they've accrued, you know, there's lots of different IHT planning you can do, normal gifting, etc., normal expenditure rules, all that sort of stuff advisors are really, really up to speed on. You know, they're going to be thinking about those things now. If people haven't taken their tax-free cash at age 75, you should think about it, perhaps take into account your wider needs, wants, etc., for your strategy. I've also been hearing people saying, look, it means that people will be drawing down their pension fund earlier. I think so. To what degree depends on what your plan is for you, your spouse, how long you think going to last, what expenditure you need. It is using the pension for ultimately what was intended for, was providing for you in later life, rather than a mechanism to help the next generation. You can still, you know, take money out of pensions, and you can still put into grandchildren's ISAs and everything else. What you want to do, basically, it's up to you. So in that regard, you know, advisors have probably got to have these conversations. Now, clients have already heard about this one. You know, it isn't something which is brand new. They'll have had a lot of their clients on the phone already. Advisors will have already segmented their book, I have no doubt, looking at the ones who These guys we need to contact fairly swiftly.
Yeah.
These ones we need to think about a different withdrawal strategy. Mm. Whether that's taking tax-free cash, etc., or maybe funding a separate life policy to cover any IHT which could come up. The problem on that one is that my view is the effective rates of IHT could stay as they are in that consultation document.
Yeah.
They could. Seem a bit high in places, to be honest. So, you know, we shall see as that goes through. It's a tricky element. My sort of view is that there's a couple of bits which are a bit unclear. So there was one line in the consultation document under Annex B. Annex B has all the various different types of pension death benefits which are going to be subject to IHT, and I'd say any advice firm should really be checking all that sort of stuff to make sure they have a reasonable understanding. But there's one line which basically said, which alluded that any death in service which is provided for using a life policy related to an employer package is effectively outside the scope of this. So we are trying to understand exactly what this means, because it could mean that a lot of death in service stuff is outside of this. Some of the death in service can use up a significant amount of allowances. It could significantly increase the amount in your estate. That is quite a key element that I think needs clarity fairly swiftly. I'm hoping we'll get that clarity relatively soon.
Yeah.
The consultation goes until January.
Yeah.
There are going to be HMRC working groups at the end of this month where you get into some of the detail there. We're hoping that, you know, they'll be relatively swift on some of the points which they've outlined in the consultation. So we've got a bit more clarity, because advisors are going to have to do something relatively soon. They can't wait 2 years.
Mm. What do you think the legacy of this budget will be then in 5 years' time? How will the government look back at their work on this budget? Do you think it could be successful, or is it a high risk?
I think it's a high risk, and I hope it works. I think we all hope it works, because we need growth. We do need growth in the economy, because it drives so many different aspects, not just the pensions policy. I mean, you know, pension policy is clearly interesting to us, and adequacy in retirement is important. But, you know, unless we can get the UK growth moving forward, then living standards are going to continue, relatively speaking, to drop. There has been need for increased expenditure in public services. That's absolutely key. So I think, in a way, they'll look at it and go, we had no choice.
Yeah.
I think this Chancellor, though, has staked her reputation on long-term growth, though.
Yeah.
But it's a bitter pill for us to take, because sometimes we look at this and we say, we don't like all this short-termism. We have a Chancellor who comes along and says, I'm going to put a budget out for long-term. We go, we don't really like that either.
Yeah,
let's be honest, we don't really like any of these tax rises. Nobody likes. I'm in the camp where I'm not so sure about where these tax rises have come. I think there could have been other areas they could have looked at. And to be honest, the complexity of the UK tax system hasn't got any easier as a result of this budget at all. But, you know, did this government have a mandate to do wide tax reform? Probably didn't run on that, to be honest. But perhaps if we had a simpler tax system, it would make things run a lot easier, and then you wouldn't get these really strange sort of outcomes which catch people off guard and are particularly, you know, unpalatable and hit the headlines.
Yeah.
You know, effective tax rates that we're talking about, IHT up to 90%, is theoretically possible based on what they've announced. But, you know, it just looks, you look at it and think it's just absolutely crazy. But that's the tax system that we have because of just tinkering with it. So
yeah.
It's an interesting one. I mean, if you look at the where we will be in 5 years' time, I think advisors will be looking at very different now in terms of the assets which clients hold, especially at the higher end.
Mm.
Whether that's, you know, from my perspective, the sorts of things we get involved in, whether it's a move from general investments accounts to probably things like more sort of investment bonds. And, you know, investment bonds are pretty good from that point of view. I think we've already started to see that shift because the reductions in CGT annual exempt amounts. You know, we have investment bonds, which are really good, child events regime. And, you know, you're hidden from those CGT charges. You have life policy tax charges. And you've got your, you can basically manage when you actually get your child events, though, later on. So we're going to see, I think, a shift into investment bonds. And maybe a lot of advisors out there weren't around when investment bonds were big. And, you know, probably they're taking more out of their investment bonds than they put into them. But, you know, they've got to take into account those sort of structures more so going forward.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see perhaps more money coming out of pensions, whether it's neutral across a client's entire spectrum of assets, maybe. So maybe we'll see more coming out of pensions and less coming out elsewhere, more being put into other assets, maybe a bit of earlier IHT planning. But this is just a thing that advisors can go, do you know what, it was painful at the time, but more clients now come to us because it's more complicated. And you could argue that when they get the advice guidance review through, more people go and seek guidance. I think, crumbs, this is really complicated. I don't want to do it on my own.
Yeah.
And I go and push more advice. So I think whilst it's painful, I think the demand for advice is going to increase.
Yeah.
John Greer, thank you very much.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.